Well, good evening. Thank you very much for the kind words of welcome. It's lovely to be here and to share with you some think about the suffering of the Lord Jesus Christ from a medical perspective. There are some things in life which are very familiar. There's some things that we would see on a daily and on a weekly basis, and even as a child, they've become ingrained into our lives. Things that we hear, things that we smell, things that we have tasted, which bring back memories and evoke emotions. Let me give you an example. Every morning on my way into work, I drive past these two cranes. Who knows the name of the two cranes? Good, Samson and Goliath. I've said this before and people have said David and Goliath, but it's not. It's definitely Samson and Goliath. I've been fascinated by these cranes even as a child, and every morning I drive past and I'm always looking to see what they're doing, and they're still working, and if you drive past at the minute you'll see they're erecting some sort of fantastic metal work for offshore wind farms, I think, at the minute. But if you drive past you'll see, and they're working away. But they're so familiar, but do you really know much about them? You see, Goliath was built in 1969. Samson was built in 1974. Goliath stands 96 metres tall, and Samson is a bit taller at 106 metres. The span of them is 140 metres, and at the time when they were built, Harland and Wolff was one of the biggest shipbuilders in the world. They have a lifting capacity of over 800 tons, and if you put them both together, they can lift together 1,600 tons. Whenever they were testing them, they tried to lift 1,000 tons and bent the gantry. So the gantry of Samson is bent ever so slightly by 30 centimetres. They're very familiar. We see them every day. I see them every day. They're listed buildings in Belfast. But do you know that much about them? Who manufactured the cranes? Does anybody know? Krupp, excellent. Very good. Krupp, and if you look, you can see it on the side. It's painted over now. You can't see it quite so clearly, but you can see Krupp. What do you know about Krupp? Krupp is an interesting company. It's German. It's been going for 400 years in the Krupp family dynasty, and Krupp built munitions for World War I and World War II. They built tanks. They were allies of Hitler. They employed Jews in their factories to build the munitions. And over the span of World War II, they may have employed 250,000 Jewish slaves. The RAF bombed their factory in Essen during World War II. In 1970, Krupp was part taken over by the Iranians, and recently it merged with Thyssen. They become Thyssen Krupp in 1990. They now make lifts and elevators, which you may have seen. You see, you scratch the surface. We see these cranes regularly, but you scratch the surface. There's so much more going on. It's good to examine things more closely that we're familiar with. As Christians, the cross is central to our lives. We meet weekly around the Lord's table and remember his sufferings. But sometimes is it all just a little bit too familiar? Are we maybe missing some of the horror and awfulness of Calvary? Matthew 27, please. Matthew 27. Matthew 27 and verse 27. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers, and they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand and bowed the knee And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. And after that they had mocked him, they took the robe off from him and put his own raiment on him and led him away to crucify him. And as they came out, they found a man, Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled him to bear his cross. And when they were come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of the skull, they gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, "They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots." And sitting down, they watched him there. Let's watch him there tonight in just a little bit more detail. I'm not an expert in this at all, and you can read lots of different books and papers on the subject, and there's lots of different views on some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about any of it because the evidence isn't there. But I thought this is interesting, and it'll give us a new perspective on something which is very familiar, and hopefully tonight you'll get a fresh vision of the suffering of the Lord. This is a medical journal. It's called JAMA, the Journal of the Association, the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a cover from one of the journals in December past, and it's a journal was based on medical education. Interestingly, the paper, the picture, some of you might recognize it. It's from the surrealist artist René Magritte. He painted this in 1964. This is a version of it. It's actually called The Son of Man, which is quite interesting. But this was about medical education. And we do some courses about how to teach medical students. And we're told that the average attention span of a medical student is 7 minutes. So I'm used to doing short talks, so you don't need to worry about being kept very long tonight. This journal is a big journal. It's a very important journal. I'm sure you've heard of the British Medical Journal. And that's a big journal in the UK. Journal importance is measured by something called the impact factor. How important it is its impact factor. The British Medical Journal has an impact factor of 14. This journal, JAMA, has an impact factor of 30. That means it's world-renowned. And everybody in the medical field knows about JAMA as a journal. So if you publish something in JAMA, it's really pretty important and people will take it seriously. There was a doctor called William Edwards, and in 1986 he published a paper in JAMA outlining his views on the physical death of Jesus Christ. He was a pathologist from the Mayo Clinic, again a very famous unit in America, and he wanted to look at how the Lord actually died, and he based his evidence, obviously he didn't have a body, but he based his evidence on what he could find from the scriptures, from the gospels, and from other historical records. And I'm indebted to his paper, because a lot of what I say tonight is based on what he has written in this piece of work. So let me take you on a journey around Jerusalem. It's around AD 33. We're going to start in the upper room, and we're going to follow the Lord as he's walked around Jerusalem. And the total distance that he would have covered that night was about 2.5 miles. And there are some very familiar places that we're going to go to. And we're going to go to those familiar places to watch him there. The first place we're going to go to is Gethsemane. And we're going to watch him in Gethsemane. Then we're going to move on to Gabbatha. And we're going to watch him there. And then finally we're going to finish up with Golgotha. So we're going to look at those three separate places, and we're going to take a medical view on some of the physical sufferings of the Lord in those places. So the first one we're going to go to is Gethsemane. We're going to watch him in Gethsemane. If you have your Bibles again, Luke 22, please, verse 39. Luke 22, verse 39, "And he came out and went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, Pray that ye enter not into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them, and about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground." Verse 44, sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. Let's look at something which we have heard so often, we're familiar with it, but let's drill into it a little bit more. Let's look at the detail. Firstly, did the Lord really literally sweat great drops of blood? Has this already been described medically? And how does it happen? There is very definitely a condition where you can sweat blood, and it's got a name. It's called hematidrosis. Hematidrosis. And it's a real condition, so real that it's actually recognized in the ICD codes of the World Health Organization, the International Classification of Disease, and they give every single condition a code. So if you were unfortunate enough to have a malignant tumor of your sigmoid colon, you would have a condition which is C18.7. Or if you were unfortunate enough to have a myocardial infarction of the anterior wall of your heart, or a heart attack, it would be I21.0. But hematidrosis gets a code, and it's L74.8. So this is a real condition recognized by the World Health Organization. On the screen, you'll see a cross-section of skin. I'm sure you've seen pictures like this before. But you can see at the top, we've got the little hairs, and then we've got the epidermis, which is the top layer of skin. Down beneath that, we've got the dermis, and then we've got the yellow stuff at the bottom, which is subcutaneous fat. That layer is thicker in some people and thinner in others. But in this dermis is where all the clockwork lies. And we can see here we've got the hairs going down into the hair follicle. We've got the little erector pili muscle, which lifts your hairs up when you're cold. You've got a little gland, an apocrine gland, beside the hair, which puts greasy material into the hair. And then over here we've got the sweat gland. And surrounding the sweat gland there are lots of little blood vessels. There was a chap called Kluger from Helsinki in Finland, and he recently published a paper in a dermatology journal, and he reviewed the literature over the past 10 years, and he only found 25 cases worldwide of hematidrosis. That was between 1996 and 2016. He discovered that about half of the cases, hematidrosis was due to severe psychological stress. Examples given were in the war situation, particularly when men and women too were going into battle. In the First World War, there's examples of it when men were going up over the trenches. On death row, before going to the electric chair in America, there's examples of hematidrosis. But how does it occur? It occurs because these little blood vessels around the sweat gland, because of the severe adrenaline rush, the blood vessels go into spasm and they burst, and then the blood leaks out into the sweat gland, and then as the person sweats, the blood spills out onto the skin surface. It is associated with profound sadness and intense suffering. See, Gethsemane was a very familiar place for the Lord. He went there to pray. He withdrew himself from them to where the olive trees were. He was preparing himself for what was to come. Angels came and strengthened him. He was abandoned by his friends. He was abandoned and separated from the Father. Luke 22 reminds us, and being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. Certainly here, there's enough mental anguish to explain hematidrosis. So we move from Gethsemane to Gabbatha. John 19, verse 13, please. John 19, verse 13. Just one verse. When Pilate therefore heard them saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now there's some debate as to where Gabbatha might be. Gabbatha is Aramaic for pavement. It might be in the fortress of Antonia, which is a military barracks, perhaps contained around 600 soldiers. It was Pilate's official residence. It was built by Herod the Great in 19 BC for his friend Mark Antony. It is likely that the pavement or Gabbatha was adjacent to the Praetorium. That's where Pilate sat on his judgment seat. And the tessellated pavement was just adjacent to this area. And some archaeologists have found that on these pavement stones there were chiseled out games, gambling games, which the soldiers played. The soldiers played these gambling games while they guarded the prisoners who were in cells around the pavement. So let's watch him at Gabbatha. Mark 15, please. Mark 15, verses 16 and 17. And the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium. And they called together the whole band, and they clothed him with purple and plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head. So we want to look at several different things that happened in the Praetorium or on Gabbatha, the pavement. And the first is the crown of thorns. It's not absolutely certain which thorny plant was used to make the crown of thorns. There are a number of hypotheses. The first, and the one that I like, is a plant called Euphorbia mille. It was native of Madagascar, and it was known to grow in the Middle East at that time. The thorns could grow to about 3 centimetres in length. Imagine this plant then being plaited and then pressed into the scalp of the Lord Jesus Christ. There's two very important things to mention about the scalp. These are pictures from Frank Netter, who's a very famous anatomist. And the first is, there's lots and lots of nerves in the scalp. And you can see this picture, there's just innumerable number of nerves in the scalp. And the scalp itself is not particularly thick. You don't have to go terribly far before you're on top of bone, the bone of the skull. The second thing to say, which I'm sure you will know if you've ever cut your head, is the scalp is very vascular. There are lots of blood vessels. It's probably one of the most vascular areas of skin in the body. And if you cut the scalp in A&E, you have to get it closed as quickly as you can. And you see them doing very ignorant things, like just getting big staples and clipping it. That's to stop the bleeding. And the quickest way to stop it is to get it closed. It bleeds an awful lot, and you can lose a lot of blood from the scalp. Put on top of that, the fact that the Lord had hematidrosis with blood in his sweat. The sweat glands in his scalp would be very tender. And on top of that, the crown of thorns, which pushed into the one of the most vascular areas of the body, one of the most sensitive areas of the body, with long thorns, 3 centimetres in length, potentially scraping down onto the bone of the skull. And then on top of that, the crown of thorns being struck with a reed. Not only would there be pain and blood loss from the crown of thorns, but listen to this. If we assume, and I accept it's an assumption, that Euphorbia mille may have been the plant used to make the crown of thorns, this is from the poisons database. Listen to this, the poisons database. 3 patients presented with accidental ocular exposure to the milky sap of the euphoria species. The initial symptoms were severe burning sensation in the eyes, with blurring of vision, reduction in visual acuity, only able to count fingers. Clinical findings varied from conjunctivitis to severe corneal edema, uveitis, elevated intraocular pressure. Guidance: people who handle euphoria plants should wear eye protection. Not only was the crown of thorns incredibly painful, being in the scalp, not only did it cause a lot of bleeding, it is possible that the milky sap from the crown of thorns could have got into the Lord's eyes and caused severe eye irritation to the point where he probably couldn't see. Genesis 3 verse 18 says, "Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, thou shalt eat the herb of the field." Thorns, obviously, as we all know, are symbolic of sin. And the crown of thorns is symbolic of the fact that he bore our sin in his own body on the tree, as it says in 1 Peter 2:24. So in Gabbatha, there's the crown of thorns. In Gabbatha, there's also scourging. The crown of thorns was bad. Scourging is diabolical. It was done with a thing called a flagrum, which is this here. Wooden handle with leather thongs and small pieces of bone and bare metal balls at the end. And two Roman soldiers were tasked with using this. And they were very good at it. And they had to be very good at it because the point of the process was to inflict as much pain as possible, but without killing the person. So they had to take them to the point of death. And normally the stripes were 39, and the two of them would go at it in turns. There would be a huge amount of blood loss as the little bits of bone and metal would not only eat through the skin but bite into the muscles of the back, which would result in extreme dehydration. And I think this really brings into focus Psalm 22, verse 12 to 15. "And they gaped upon me with their mouths as a raving and roaring lion. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. Thou hast brought me into the dust of death." 1 Peter 2:24, "By whose stripes we are healed." And Psalm 129, verse 3, "The ploughers ploughed upon my back and made their long furrows." And then, of course, after doing that, they then would have put a purple robe on him. And I'm sure you've all grazed your elbow or your knee and it's got stuck to your clothes afterwards. Imagine that in this setting, and then that robe later being removed after it had stuck onto the wounds of the back. So we've looked at Gethsemane and the hematidrosis, and we've looked at Gabbatha and the crown of thorns and the scourging. So now we have to walk around Jerusalem a little bit more, and we'll come to Golgotha. So Mark 15, please. Mark 15, and a couple of verses there. "And they compel one Simon, a Cyrenian, who passed by, coming out of the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they bring him onto a place, Golgotha, which is, being interpreted, the place of a skull." So the Lord is clearly going to be completely physically exhausted after the scourging. It's probably about a 600 meter walk from the pavement, Gabbatha, to Golgotha. I suspect he may have started off that walk carrying the cross, but very clearly it wasn't going to continue. So the soldiers then found this guy in the crowd, Simon from North Africa, possibly Libya, 900 odd miles away, and he'd come to Jerusalem for the Passover. And if he was to touch the cross or touch blood, as was going to happen, he would therefore be unclean and not be able to take part in the Passover. But the Lord was so weak, he was unable to bear it himself and didn't protest, and he was clearly brought as a lamb to the slaughter and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb. It was traditional for the condemned man to carry his own cross, but a whole cross probably is too heavy. So you, in your mind, you have the picture of somebody carrying a cross-shaped thing. But that's probably not the way it was. The cross was 130 kilograms. And it would appear historically that it wasn't the whole cross that was carried. It was the horizontal bit. The horizontal bit's called the patibulum. And the vertical bit's called the stipes. And you probably could just about manage to carry the patibulum at 50 kilograms. The stipes remained in place, so it was there. And then whenever the prisoner arrived with the patibulum, they were then lifted up onto the stipes, and there were special hooks that the soldiers had where they could lift them up, or they sometimes used ladders to get the prisoner up onto the cross. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. The act of crucifixion was probably developed in Persia. It was adopted by the Romans, but there was lots of variation as to how it was done. And in some ways it was sort of down to the imagination of the executioners as to how they performed the whole process. There was a thing called a titulus, which was a plaque which carried the name of the prisoner and the crimes that he had done. And a Roman soldier carried that with him and then put that on the cross. Often the prisoners were offered wine mingled with myrrh or gall, and that was used as a painkiller. It was called by the Romans vinum myrrha conditum, and it was a painkiller, a bit like codeine, and it would dampen down the senses somewhat. But of course the Lord, he received it not. John 20 verse 25, the other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I see the hands, the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. We've looked at the cross, let's look at the nails. These were tapered spikes of iron, perhaps 18 to 20 centimetres long, maybe a centimetre or so in diameter. These nails have been found. We know what they look like. There's even some bones with needles in them which have been found. And it was the preferred method of securing their victim to the cross. But where did the nail go? This is an x-ray of a hand. And traditionally you think the nail went right in the middle of the hand. But it can't actually have went into the middle of the hand, because if you put it in the middle of the hand, it's just going to slide out in between those metacarpal bones. So if you put the nail in the middle of the hand, it's going to sit there, it's just going to pull through. So they didn't put it there. The nails probably went here, which is about there. And that's through a little set of bones called the carpal bones. But of course, in John 19:36, not a bone of him shall be broken. So how did they manage to do that? Well, these executioners were very skilled at finding a little space described by a French anatomist called Dessau's space. And it's between four of those little bones, between the lunate, the trichetrum, the hamate, and the capitate. Between those little four little bones, there's a little space. And they were very good at getting the nail right into that space. And it fixed it very, very securely because it was wedged in between those little bones, and there's some very tough tendons across the palm of your hand to keep everything in place. But there's something else very interesting about where this nail went. There's some other very important structure that runs through that part of your hand, and it's called the median nerve. I'm not sure anybody here has been troubled with a condition called carpal tunnel syndrome. That's when your median nerve gets trapped. And when that happens, you get awful pain in your hand, so bad that it awakens you from your sleep. And people describe that their hand goes a bit numb and they hang it out at the end of the bed and shake it. That's called carpal tunnel syndrome. And that's because the median nerve is compressed at the wrist. I'm sure you've all banged your elbow on a door or something, and you've hit your elbow and you get this awful shooting pain in your hand, that your funny bone. And that's when you bang your ulnar nerve, which runs at the back of your elbow. But the median nerve is one of the other nerves that goes to your hand, and it runs through your wrist. This nail would have gone right through the median nerve, absolutely right through it. So it would have been excruciatingly painful for that large nail to go right through the median nerve. The other interesting thing about that is it causes paralysis in the hand. And if you've got a median nerve palsy or your median nerve is not working and you try to make a fist, your hand looks like that. The other aspect, of course, is of Golgotha is the actual crucifixion. And there's a lot of discussion about how crucifixion actually worked. How did it cause death? One thing's for sure about it, it was a very slow death, and it was very painful, and that's the way it was designed. It did have an effect on how you breathe. So as you're sitting there now, everybody take a big breath in. Take a big breath in. That's an active process. You're actually sucking air in, you're lifting up your chest, you're using your muscles to breathe in, and then whenever you let it go, that sort of happens by itself. Okay, you don't need to do anything, the air just comes out of your lungs, and that's a passive process. The opposite happens on the cross. So if you're hanging on a cross, you have to make a real effort to breathe out. You have to make a real effort to exhale. And you can only do that for so long. And in the process of making a huge effort to exhale, your breaths get shallower and shallower. And that causes a buildup of carbon dioxide in your body and in your bloodstream, which causes your blood to become more acidic. And that has huge, then, spiraling knock-on effects. The chances of surviving on a cross for more than a few hours really depended on the level of scourging beforehand. If the victim came to the cross in a terrible state, they probably would only last a few hours. But if not, they could be there for days. It was a very slow and a very painful process. In trauma, we call it the death triad, which doesn't sound great, but it happens in major trauma. If somebody's had a major injury, they usually lose a lot of blood. And what happens is the blood becomes more acidic. And when your blood becomes more acidic, it stops clotting. You don't clot. We talk about red ink. So your blood doesn't form a clot anymore. It just bleeds everywhere. And you also get into trouble with hypothermia. And if you're cold, again, your blood doesn't clot. And there's no doubt that on the cross, exposed, the way the Lord would have been, he would have been hypothermic and his blood would not have clotted. One other aspect, and we're nearly finished, to look at on the cross was the spear. John 19, verse 34, but one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side and forthwith came out blood and water. I've thought about this quite a lot, and I've read a bit about it, and I'm not sure there's a fantastically good explanation for it. Some people think it's purely spiritual, and obviously there's spiritual significance of the blood and the water. But I would also like to think that this physically was blood and water that came out. And I think you can make it fit. There are definitely options as to how that could be the case. I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but I think there are certainly possibilities. It was the custom that the bodies were not taken down until they were dead. So thrusting a spear into the side confirms death and puts to bed any notion that the Lord didn't actually die. Probably the right side of the chest, that would seem to be the custom at the time. The Greek word for side used in Scripture is pleura. And pleura, whenever we use the word pleura medically, we're talking about the lungs and we're talking about the lining of the lungs. So this was probably the right side and probably the right side of the chest. But why blood and water? I suspect this illustrates that this was a post-mortem event. So if you leave some blood out long enough, this is what happens to it. It turns into plasma and the red cells settle to the bottom. This looks very much like blood and water. But dead bodies don't bleed, of course. So how did this come out? I suspect the blood and the plasma was in a body cavity. So it was either around the lungs or around the heart. And this is a CT scan of somebody's chest. So you may have seen CT scans before. This is a cross-section through the body. This is the spine at the back, and this is the chest at the front. That's the breastbone at the top. And these are ribs, and then the big black areas are the lungs. And this in the middle is supposed to be where the heart is, but this heart's very abnormal. The heart bits should be just in the middle, and it's full of dye that was given. And some of the dye is leaking out of the heart because the heart has burst or ruptured. And around the heart, there is a sac of fluid. It's called a pericardial effusion. And if somebody was beaten or under a lot of stress or trauma or their heart was failing, you can get fluid gathering around the heart. So if a spear was to go in through the right side, which would be this side and here, you would hit the water and under the heart and you would get the blood. Now, that's just a hypothesis. I wouldn't be certain about that. But there's definitely a physical possibility that this really did happen and blood and water did flow out. So we've looked at Gethsemane, we've looked at Gabbatha, and we've looked at Golgotha, and we've watched him there in each of those places. Whenever people die in hospital, we have to fill out death certificates. And it's usually the most junior doctors that fill them out, and sometimes you don't know what to put on them, and they'll come and ask, well, what am I going to put down? And you tell them what you're going to put down. And sometimes if we really don't know, we'll have to do a post-mortem. Sometimes we'll have to speak to the coroner. You maybe have had experience with death certificates. They're filled out like this, and if you were filling one out for how the Lord died, this is what you might put on it. So you might put, disease or condition directly leading to death, multi-organ failure, due or as a consequence of asphyxiation, that's the not being able to breathe properly on the cross, due to or as a consequence of, which is the wording we use in death certificates, trauma of crucifixion, due or a consequence of trauma of scourging, other significant conditions contributing to death but not related to the disease, hemorrhage and exhaustion. This is all very good, but it doesn't actually matter how the Lord died. Cause of death isn't that important, because this is what's really written on the death certificate. Disease or condition directly leading to death. He gave up his own life. John 10, verses 17 to 18. No man take it from me, but I lay it down of myself. Due to or as a consequence of, he loved us so much. Ephesians 5 verse 2. And walk in love as Christ also loved us and hath given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savour. Due to or as a consequence of doing the Father's will. John 6:38. Not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Other significant factors are sin. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 21. For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be the righteousness of God in him. So thank you for listening. We have watched him in Gethsemane, hematidrosis, the intense pain and agony psychologically that he went through in Gethsemane. We have watched him in Gabbatha with the crown of thorns and the bleeding and the pain and the possible irritation of the eyes, the scourging and how awful that was at Gabbatha. And then at Golgotha, how he wasn't able to carry that heavy cross, how the nails went into his hands through that median nerve, and how the spear went into his side, and how he had a long and painful and slow death of crucifixion on the cross. So thank you for listening. Hopefully that's given you a fresh vision of the sufferings of the Lord, something which is very familiar, something that we remember every week around the table. But we've just scratched the surface a little more and delved into it a little bit more deeply. And maybe the next time when you meet around the Lord's table, you'll remember some of these thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that.